Okay, we have today Nir, and we are gonna make a podcast express about him and his scientific career. So if you can introduce yourself and tell us where you were born, where you grew up, as a start.
Sure. So my name is Nir Drayman. I was born in Israel. That's where I did my undergraduate and PhD. That's where I met my husband. We were there for a long time until we moved to the U.S. to do our postdocs.
So how did you first become interested in science, biology, and viruses? How that happened?
So I've always been interested in biology. I started taking... So the Tel Aviv University has these courses for teenagers that you can take over the summer and, like, everything from geology to astrophysics. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, started taking these because I was interested in all kinds of stuff. And the microbiology one, like, captured me. Mm-hmm. Like, the very first time we did a plaque essay with bacteriophages, it was like, okay, I want to study viruses. These are cool. So I did my BA during high school. Mm-hmm. So I started at the Open University, where you can study in parallel to high school. And I did half of my degree between 15 and 18. And then in Israel, you have mandatory service in the army. Mm-hmm. But they have an agreement with the Open University that if you finish half of your degree by the time you're 18, they'll postpone your service for 1 year so you can finish your degree. So I did half of my degree in 4 years in high school and the other half in 1 year.
Okay, so
before the service. Then I did my army service, and when I was done, I applied to grad school. And in Israel at that time, it was not really a formal process. I just emailed a person, mm-hmm. and I said, hey, can I be a PhD student? And she was like, come interview. And I interviewed, and then I was a PhD student.
In Israel as well.
In Israel, okay. At the mm-hmm. Hebrew University mm-hmm. in Jerusalem. And like most parts of my scientific career, everything was very disorganized and happened by chance. I'm a big believer in life is what happens when you make other plans. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to do gene therapy because that sounded cool. Mm-hmm. So I looked at people who do gene therapy at the Hebrew University. And because my supervisor's name was Ariella Oppenheim, so she was first on the list. Oh, her initials are AO. Mm-hmm. And I emailed her. And I came to interview, and she talked about her research, and I talked to her grad students, and it all sounded very interesting. And I joined, and I've never done gene therapy. So I've done basic virus-host interactions, working on polyomaviruses, on SV40 for my 7 years as a PhD student. Never done any gene therapy projects, and it was...
How did you get captured by virology when you thought you were going to do gene therapy?
So gene therapy is, you know, intimately linked to virology.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's all about how do you get the genes into mm-hmm. the
yeah.
cell. And
that was a system.
And a big part of that is virology, right? Mm-hmm. Like all of the successful gene therapies are adeno-associated viruses, or like taking a virus, changing its genetic makeup, so it will deliver whatever gene therapy you want into the cell. Mm-hmm. So I knew she was working on SV40 as a vector for gene therapy. But then when I actually joined the lab, there was all of these cell biology projects. And she said, you know, start with that. And that turned out to be my PhD project.
And how did you do that jump from postdoc? Because, of course, you were a postdoc afterwards. What happened between your PhD and next steps?
Yeah, so as again, all of these were a lot to do to chance. So I did my PhD and I was waiting for my husband to finish his PhD. We were always like 2 years apart because when we met, he just started undergrads and I was studying grad school, mm-hmm. or he was in the middle of his undergrad. So I finished my PhD and I wanted to do a short postdoc in Israel. And I knew I wanted to be in the Weizmann Institute because that's like the top science institute in Israel. So I said if I was going to do a postdoc, it might as well be like our top premier institute. And I talked to a bunch of people, and Uri Alon, who's a systems biologist and the one I ended up doing a postdoc with, had this really cool system where they had a library of cells, about 1,000 clones. Each one had YFP tagging the host protein. And this was before CRISPR, right? So this was a very unique tool there. And the idea was that we were going to take fluorescent influenza viruses, infect the cells, monitor the host proteins and the viral protein, and then distinguish which host proteins determine infection outcome. So if something was high and then the cell got infected, then that would be a proviral factor. Something was low and then the cell got infected, that would probably be an antiviral factor. So I was going to work on influenza, but the influenza virus, and I needed a fluorescent influenza virus. There was a protocol out there to clone them. I tried. It works, but you kept getting revertants. So influenza, fluorescent influenza is not very stable. And I was very frustrated. And I went to a meeting in Israel, and I met a friend, and I was bitching about my fluorescent influenza viruses, not playing along. And he was like, hey, I have HSV. I have herpes simplex virus in all the colors of the rainbow, and it's stable, and you can have it. And that's how I became a herpes virologist. It was a chance meeting at a conference, and I've been doing HSV-1 ever since.
Doesn't revert that much, I guess.
Sorry?
It doesn't revert as much as influenza.
It does not revert. You can get very stable.
RNA, the other DNA stays.
Yeah, and HSV-1, so, you know, I've worked with small DNA viruses, polyomaviruses in my PhD, and these will not tolerate any significant insert into their genome. They will start randomly deleting stuff. There's a very limited coding capacity. It's basically a plasmid. It's a 5.2 kb genome. Where you go to herpes, and it's 150 kb, and it couldn't care less if you stick a GFP on it. So I did that. Then, when it was time to do our real postdocs in the U.S., my husband found his postdoc at Northwestern, so in the suburbs of Chicago. And I said, okay, we're going to Chicago. Let me see who's around. And I emailed two labs. Both didn't respond. So I emailed one of them again. I was like, no, I'm actually interested in, you know, being a postdoc, so let me know if, like, you don't want me. So then he invited me to interview, and I did my postdoc with him. It's Savash Tai at the University of Chicago. And he's also a systems biologist. So both of my postdoc with people who don't know any virology.
And it's only because you insisted to go there, other ways.
Because I think systems biologists have this, in general, this cool notion that it's not about the specific biological system you're working with. So it's principles and the big picture of biology. So the tools are high throughput or single cells or whatever they are, but the questions can be very different, right? You can have one project which is about stem cells, one project about some signaling pathway, another project about viruses, and these all fit under the same umbrella because the methods are the same.
Very open environment, right?
At least the one that I've been at, you know, I wouldn't talk for all the systems biologists out there.
Okay.
But yeah, I think it's easier to convince a systems biologist to work on viruses than to take someone who's been trained in classical virology and make them do system biology approaches. Or at least it was. I think today, like, people are more open to it. So I found my postdoc at the University of Chicago, and the project I pitched was to use some machine learning approaches to try and predict infection outcomes of cells, and very quickly it got derailed because we realized our preliminary data had some issues with it and it's probably not going to work. But that was about the time that single-cell RNA sequencing came online. So it was before 10x and before commercial, but it was already, like, well-established and there were papers on it. And we've set up in the lab DropSeq, which was the homemade version of 10x, or you know, the concept around which 10x built the commercial platform. And we did the first single-cell RNA sequencing of HSV-1 infected cells. So today I kind of feel embarrassed when I say that was, like, my claim to fame, because, like, so what? You did single-cell RNA sequencing. Everyone does it.
It was long ago.
But when we did it back then, it was, like, it was new. It was novel. And, like, you know, the main conclusion of the paper was there's a lot of heterogeneity in infection, which today is like, duh.
Yeah, but it's like the real proof is like very well described and
lot no, of I agree. Afterwards. And I'm still very proud of it. It was really an uphill battle because, you know, some of the more senior people in the field really didn't get what we were trying to do. They were like, these are cells. They're all the same. What is all this, you know, crap about noise and variability? And I think there have been two phases for that in virology. Very early on in virology, people were interested in single cells. If you look at papers from the 40s, 50s, you have people doing single cell virology. They've infected cells, they separated them, they try to see how many viruses are produced by individual cells. It's extremely hard to do, even in today's techniques, definitely in the 50s.
Yep.
And they quickly came to roadblocks, right? Because you can describe, okay, the burst size is different, but that's it. There wasn't even PCR, right? Like there was nothing to bring you to a mechanistic understanding after the initial phenotype. So people were interested in that since the beginning because it makes sense. We want to know the atomic unit of virology is a cell. So you want to know in a single cell what is happening because it's different for each one of the infected cells. But the way virology went after that initial wave, it was like, okay, you know what? We understand there's variability. We're just going to use a really high MOI and we're going to pretend there isn't variability. So then there came the phase of an MOI of 10 or 100, and that's what we were measuring. Which even there, when you look at it, there is variability. But obviously, it takes a lot of the variability out if you just pour a lot of viruses on your cells and sort of everything becomes successfully infected.
And non-physiological as well, probably.
Yeah, I think it's a good question about what's physiological in MOI. I think even what is MOI is like a poorly described parameter. So like in my lab, we spend some group meetings talking about what is an MOI, because MOI is like not a magical number. It's very dependent on what cell type you use and what your infection protocol is.
Very relative, yeah.
Because, you know, if you take the same cells and you infect them with, I don't know, in a six well with 200 microliters or 400 microliter, you're going to get different numbers of plaques. And obviously your inoculum hasn't changed, right? But you're going to calculate a different titer for it and therefore a different MOI. So I think MOI is a very functional definition. And people maybe ascribe to it a bit more than what it actually is.
Well, if you're at single cell level, of course.
You know, the adeno field like always uses MOIs of like 50 or 100, which other virologists don't. And like it
depends on.
Yeah, it just depends on what your question is. Sorry, I lost track of what the question
was. Yeah, continuing on your career. So was this your first postdoc, right? Then you did another one, or you started your own lab already?
Yeah, so I did a short postdoc in Israel. Then I did my major postdoc at the University of Chicago for 7 years.
Okay.
And then at year four, I started looking for positions. And because we were looking for two positions, because my husband is also in academia, he was doing his own postdoc and wanted to open his own lab. It took us 3 years to find a place that would take us both and we were both happy with. So there were great opportunities for each of us separately along the way that didn't fit the other one.
Very complicated to fit private life and science always.
Yeah, but I also feel like it might be slightly easier in some respect than if you're one of you is a scientist and the other one is a lawyer.
Something else, yeah.
Because if it's two scientists, then, you know, you both get it, right? That you move a lot and that you need to go through this weird process of a job search. Well, if one of you is a lawyer, it's like, why aren't you just getting another job?
Not that easy.
What's the big deal here? So I was already like halfway through my postdoc, but it took us 3 years to actually figure it out. And the way it finally worked for us is that we came to the University of California in Irvine, and the entire UC system, the University of California, has a really good spousal hire scheme. Most places we've interviewed with, it was, okay, so one department chair would ask a favor from another department chair to look at the candidacy for the spouse. But the University of California has a system in place. So if they want one person and a spouse needs an academic position as well, they'll circulate their CV. And if another department is interested, they go through the same interview process as any other candidate. And if that department is interested in hiring them, then it only costs them a third of what it would usually cost them. Mm-hmm. They would pay a third. The other department that hires the other spouse will pay a third, and the dean will pay a third. So there's a big incentive for everyone to actually get people they want in the department, because mm-hmm. they still have to pay for them. Yeah. They're not doing anyone a favor. But if they actually want that person, they can get it for a deal, right? For a third of what it would actually cost them to hire someone under regular conditions. Mm-hmm. So I think the UC system has figured this out really well, because a lot of people who might have, you know, quote, better opportunities in other places would come to the UC system to solve the two-body problems.
Exactly.
So they get a lot of talent that maybe they would have to compete with other places for because of that policy. Mm-hmm. We're very happy there. We love our departments, and we're both in the same school.
And the place, I guess, right?
And we like California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what are you up to now?
So I opened my lab a year and a half ago.
How was the process? Was it easy? Would you do the things differently?
Would I do things differently? I don't think I would do things differently. I think it's an interesting time moving from a postdoc to an independent position where you start to see all of the stuff you didn't see before. Like 3 months took us to renovate the lab and like choose colors for the floor. And I had to choose a color for my floor, which is not something that your postdoc prepares you for. I was literally walking around with floor samples and like asking random people, which one do you like better? And then, you know, every small decision, which like, okay, which freezers to get? Because hopefully they're going to be here for the next 20 years. It's become like a huge deal. And if like you stop to think of every one of these for a week, then you get very little done. So I think it took us like 6 months to actually get everything to be able to do the first experiment. And then it's only you. So you need to find people to work with you. So the first two people who joined the lab were undergrads. And they're amazing undergrads, and they both have their own independent projects, and they're close to publishing them, and I'm very proud of them. And then slowly other people came, and now we're 10 people.
Suddenly.
And it's like, I need to manage 10 people. And like, everyone have their own life issues and experimental issues, and it's a lot.
Yeah.
So very quickly, I thought I would stay, you know, in the lab, pipetting and doing stuff. And very quickly, I'm just managing other people's project.
And they retains, right? Because I guess undergrads don't probably stay forever, right? You get people out and in.
Yeah, so because I'm only a year and a half in, we haven't had much change.
Okay.
But at the end of this year, so two of them are going to graduate. There's two master's students who are graduating. But we also have some long-term employees, right? Like I have a lab manager who's hopefully will be with me until I retire. And a grad student who just finished her first year. So, but yeah, it's exciting, and some days are frustrating, but I find like that the highs and lows are much more balanced, because when you're a postdoc, you know, some weeks nothing works and you're really down. Some weeks like your project is moving ahead and you're super high. But when you have 10 people, some stuff move along, some stuff don't. And like on the average, it balances. So I found my emotional fluctuations to be lower as a PI than it was as a postdoc.
Okay, that's a good thing to take. So from that process, would you give people some advice, some hints to take? Because it's a lot on luck, right? What's around you? Where are you? Who you know?
For moving from a postdoc, yes, or like for applying for positions sort of thing? Yeah. I'd say a couple of things. One is that I think, take everything I say with a grain of salt, because it's an N equal one. And that's everyone you talk to have their own like personal path and what worked for them. And at the end, a lot of it is down to luck. And there's a lot of survivor bias, right? Because you're only interviewing in this podcast or people out there, the people who have made the transition. And there might be there are really good people who didn't make the transition from postdoc to assistant professor because of luck. A lot of it is luck, and we're not interviewing them. So maybe everything I did, they also did, but they were unlucky in finding a position. So I'd say, you know, first make what makes sense for you. I think what I learned through this 3 years is that what you really need to master is how do you quickly and plainly discuss very complex biological issues with people who don't have your background. You have maybe 15 minutes with a search committee to persuade them to move you on to the next stage of an on-campus visit, and they want to know what it is that you're going to do once you're a professor. And you might, you know, work on a very specific protein that has a very specific function in some forgotten amoeba. It's very hard to convey that to someone who studies plants in a 15-minute talk. So that would be my number one advice. Make sure that you know very well what it is that you want to do, and that you've practiced how you convey it to people who don't share your science background and not your science interest. You need to be able to convince people that you know what you're saying, but you don't need to give them all the details. Because usually how we think of a scientist is that, okay, I'm going to describe all of the controls, and I'm going to show you all of the data, and then you'll know that I'm saying you that, you know, what I'm saying is true.
Yep.
And that's not how it works in interviews, because there's no way to do that. And that's not how human-to-human interaction works. You need to round some corners and make your arguments, you know, more simplistic than what they actually are to convey the message. So that's one big thing. The other big thing is that now being on the other side of it and participating in search committees and, like, you know, looking at application materials and stuff, a huge concern for the search committee is that they're going to make you the offer to come and you're not going to come. So that they're going to have a failed search. So you want to convince them that you've actually considered taking the position. And the most common way to do it is to show that you've actually read, you know, the bios of people in the department, not only of the search committee, that you know who are the people in the university that have similar interests to you, and you can point this out in the interview, that you know what resources are there. If you're going to use, you know, facts, and you say, yeah, and I looked in your facts core, and I know that they have the facts aria, and that's good enough for my research. Maybe down the line we can buy this, you know, new machine, which a lot of other people in that institute can also use. Because every committee is going to ask you, you know, why did you apply here? And that's not a question of, like, a bad answer is because I'm looking for a job, which is true, right? That's the reason why you apply. But, like, a good answer is explaining to them that you apply to this position because this person and that person would be very collaborative to your research agenda, that you've actually taken the time to envision your life in that department. Mm-hmm. And practice. My very first Zoom interview was for a position I really, really wanted, and I did not do well because I was super nervous. It was my very first interview, and, like, it takes time. So I would practice these.
Thanks for the advice. So we will have to finish the podcast express, and only if you want to tell us about who is the most influential person to you or one of your best mentors to finish.
There's a lot of influential people, but I'll say that the one I am, like, most appreciative of is Matthew Weitzman. He's at UPenn, and he's never been my direct supervisor, but he's offered so much support, like, across my career in applying, in reading my grants, in giving general advice, where he didn't have to, right? I was never his mentee. Mm-hmm. And he's like a scientific father figure, and I'm very appreciative of everything he's done for me. And I know a lot of people in my field also share that.
So if I can ask you another question, since you are a very scientist, so what would you be if you wouldn't be a scientist? Have you thought of that?
I think for a very long time, every year I was going to apply to medical school and haven't. So I think if I haven't been a scientist, I would probably go and try to be a doctor. maybe. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, that's all for now. Thank you for being here, Neil. And see you around.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.